Coming up on another exciting installment of That Was a Show.
Hey, have you guys seen Get a Life?
I don't know. What is it?
It's like the show from the early 90s where Chris Elliott plays a paperboy who lives with his parents.
Really? Are you serious?
Apparently.
Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince. But those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
So Barry, tell us about Get a Life.
Thanks, Aaron, I will. Get a Life was a Fox sitcom that centered around the misadventures of a 30-year-old man-child played by Chris Elliott. Chris is a paperboy who recently moved out of his parents' house into an apartment above their garage. He spends his days as essentially a live-action cartoon character forced to live in the real world. He exasperates everyone around him, from his parents to his best friend Larry and his best friend's wife Sharon. As everyone in his orbit constantly screams for him to grow up, he just shrugs with a sheepish grin and refuses to get a life. See what I did there? Oh, boy. The series co-stars Sam Roberts as Larry, Robin Riker as Larry's wife Sharon, Chris's real-life father, comedian Bob Elliott as his frustrated on-screen father, and Eleanor Donahue as his mother. In season two, Brian Doyle Murray joins the cast. It was created by Chris Elliott, Adam Resnick, and David Merkin, and had a writer's room that included later superstars Bob Odenkirk and Charlie Kaufman. It aired from September 23rd, 1990 to March 8th, 1992. Often sold as a series about a 30-year-old Dennis the Menace, the show picked up a decent cult following, mostly for its idiosyncratic and surreal sense of humor. The show's humor can best be described as bizarre as fuck, with 12 of the series' 35 episodes culminating in the lead character's death by such varied incidents as gunshot, extreme old age, choking on cereal, being crushed by a boulder, and in one instance, simply exploding. Simply put, this show is weird.
What I appreciated about this show is the simplicity of it. As compared to some of the other shows that we've recently talked about that have really complicated, multi-handed plots and deep, rich thematic elements, some of which work, some of which doesn't, but where it's a lot to unpack even what the sort of construct of the show is. And we encountered that in Sports Night. We encountered that in the John Larroquette show. This is one of the simplest shows I have ever seen.
Well, I mean, simple in terms of plot, but not simple in terms of what actually happens, because a lot of it is very expensive and high concept.
Well, very high concept. Very much like a comedy sketch stretched out into 22 minutes.
But yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
It's very, very strange. I guess I should mention we watched two episodes for review this time. We watched the pilot as well as episode 6 of season 2, which I believe was called Prisoner of Love. The show is just freaking weird. And like, I can see it picking up a cult following. I really can. I can see this airing on Adult Swim now and like, you know, reruns on Adult Swim in middle of the night. I can see it doing very well.
Yeah.
Like, it is a weird, almost, it's not quite a stoner comedy, but
it's in that, I can see what you're getting at. Yeah, it's in that realm of, you know, if you were watching Adult Swim at midnight and possibly on substances, I could see transitioning pretty smoothly from Robot Chicken straight on into this.
Yeah. I just feel like the overall feeling that I had watching it is the same as you guys. Like, I appreciated the dumb and weird humor, but the way it was carried out was weird. Like, it was like very slow pacing and awkward. It's almost like they didn't know how to direct and edit these types of bits. right?
Yeah. That's probably a really good point there, because this was a show that wasn't on TV at the time.
Yeah.
Like, there's more of this on now.
Yeah, exactly.
Than, yeah, like, you know, even like, I know you guys really like it, but like, for some reason, Detroiters came to mind, where I was just like, weird, you know, kind of offbeat, kind of almost man-child characters clashing against the real world. But we know how to cut these jokes better now.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It seems like the people involved were very much just so stuck in the standard sitcom format at the time, like the standard way of shooting and editing a sitcom. That's how it feels anyway. I don't really know the exact intentions of everybody involved, but that's how it comes across from watching it.
Yeah, I'm like, you can see
that's a good joke. I feel like I would read that script and be like, this is funny. That, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think one of the things where this show doesn't work for me is maybe it's just because it's just Chris Elliott's character against everyone.
Yeah.
That it just, like, at some point, and maybe they do over the course of the show, I would need to see other characters as weird as him, because, like, it just felt like so much. Every scene was just like him saying something super, super weird and everybody being like, oh, brother.
That's
and
a really good point.
Yeah.
You know what? That's why Detroiters works, I think, is because every character in Detroiters is weird in some way. And it's not about, like, as you say, one character who is a man child or who's kind of weird and everyone else is just constantly scolding them. It's more just weird people bouncing off of weird people. And it's almost like peeling back a layer of society and showing that, like, there's lots of weird people everywhere all going about their weird business, kind of like Portlandia does this too, of course. And those are both shows that draw from a sketch comedy tradition.
Yeah.
And they do so almost like knowing it, where they're not trying to shoehorn that into a traditional sitcom format. They're like rolling with what it calls
for. There's some great attempts at it with his parents. Where, like, his parents are very, very, they're sitcom parents, but every now and then they say something that is just so, like, off the wall. Like, like, there's, in the second episode we watched, the primary plot is that Chris has a prison pen pal that gets out and comes to live with him, and he thinks, you know, they're in love and all that. And, like, his mom just drops, like, the hardest, like, I have no time for, like prison trash or something.
Yeah,
and, but oh, it's said in, yeah, it's said in, like, her it, sweet
in her
tone
sweet
that you're just
tone,
like, wait, what?
So I literally wrote down that line because that was, like, the most, one of the most noteworthy, jarring moments for me. When the mom calls her pathetic big house scum. So in my notes, I said, thanks, Nancy Reagan, because her sort of judgmental tone in that episode came across like that. And then I realized, actually, she looks a bit like Nancy Reagan.
Yeah, yeah. That's like the template for older women with a more conservative, traditional mindset. Like that.
Judgmental moralizing.
Yes, exactly.
But it's clearly a comment on that.
Yes, like, it clearly is.
It's so extreme that you're just like,
on
what
her
the
side.
Fuck?
No.
So that's where I got to wondering, did they cast her because she kind of looks like Nancy Reagan?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. She's just very funny. Like, she's a very talented actor.
Yeah.
There was a great bit where they cut back to, they're always at his kitchen table.
Yeah.
In their bathrobe and pajamas. And I read somewhere where, like, eventually there are scenes where they're outside the house and they're just in their bathrobe and pajamas still, because it's that weird show. But one of my favorite, like, cutaways was just them, and she's putting together, like, what looks to be, like, a squirrel's skeleton.
I took it to be a dinosaur.
I missed that completely.
It's not a model of a dinosaur. She's building a skeleton of like a small mammal, like a squirrel or a cat.
So, basically. You're suggesting they might be into taxidermy.
Whatever the version of taxidermy that is just the bones is.
Yeah. Oh my God, weird. So the dynamic with the parents is very interesting, because in the first season, he lives above their garage. And it's funny because it's not the usual narrative of them trying to kick him out completely. Like, they do kind of judge him, but not, they're still supportive in other ways. which I think is a plot that could hold up today, because like the whole like idea of, okay, he's like a man child with a certain job that, you know, people are judging him for having, that doesn't really hold up in that we're kind of as a society over job shaming. And really, like a 30-year-old who like lives at home and works, you know, a certain job is just a millennial. So like, it's, you know.
Yes, but not a paperboy. A paperboy, right.
Is extreme.
A paperboy is specifically done by children.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough.
But I do think to that point, the show puts a lot of emphasis, at least it seems in the pilot or in the opening premise that it's presenting, that yeah. the reason he's a man child is because of the job. And really what it turns out to be is less the job that he has and more the fact that he doesn't even take that thing seriously.
Yeah.
Because I think we should jump back and talk about what happens in the pilot. Plot-wise, the show begins by establishing that he's a paperboy, but then he plays hooky from work and doesn't even do the job.
No, I think he does do the job.
No, he gets his job done earlier, and he's done it like 9 a.m.
Okay, so he gets his job done early.
Yeah, you see him get on the bike and get it done.
This is why he has so much time for misadventure, okay, so, because he's a paperboy.
So I took it to be that he does a bit of, like, he starts doing the job, and then he gets distracted by his friend. So I didn't realize he finished the job, but that's a good point. He might have, like, done his paper route. But anyway,
you raise a good point. He does go to his friends in the middle of delivering papers, and the adventure does continue from there.
Yeah, I took it to be that he didn't finish the gig. But,
yeah, maybe
but
not.
Regardless, I think the main focus isn't the job whatsoever. It's that he then goes and harasses his friend into playing hooky from work.
Yeah.
They go to an amusement park and then get stuck on an upside down roller coaster for 8 hours. And That's the plot of the pilot.
That's the show.
Yeah. I mean, I like his whole outlook on life. I like that he is choosing to be this way in the world. He is, you know, he's a dummy, but he's also choosing. He's like, oh, I'm a paper boy because it gives me all this time to like goof around and like live my life, you know, and he doesn't give a shit what anyone thinks.
He really doesn't. He's very high self-esteem, which is nice to see.
And I like that. And I think the problem with the show is that nobody is on his side, and nobody, at least from the little bit that we watched, like nobody actually like learns from him. Everyone just shits on him. And it's like, really, should we all be looking down on that? Like, honestly, like, I don't know. I kind of envy it.
Well, I get down on, you know, how he treats like other human beings and like women and like all
of
that.
Course.
And like his attitudes. I get what you're saying.
Everybody's horrible in the show.
I think I get what you're saying in that I think he would work as a Kramer-esque character.
Yes,
in
he's that, a Kramer.
Okay.
In that like he like
we're all getting excited by this revelation.
The show would work a little bit better if everybody else, or not everybody else, especially not everybody else, but for one or two characters to find him charming.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like Kramer's magnetism, like, you know, like Jerry finds Kramer ridiculous.
Yeah.
But other people around are just like, look at this guy. Like, he's just going about his life.
So
for him.
I'm so glad you both brought up Kramer. Hold that thought. One of my most important, biggest notes that I like triple circled that I wanted to propose a theory to both of you and see how you would react to it. And I think I already know the answer. My theory is that the basis of this show is, what if the quirky neighbor on a sitcom was the protagonist instead of the character who drops in? So I had this thought early in the pilot when he drops in on his friend by climbing in through the bedroom window.
Yeah.
And I thought, he's the Kramer or the Kimmy Gibbler or maybe even the Newman.
Yeah.
He's the quirky, weird neighbor, except the camera's with him. We're with him instead of the people that he's dropping in on.
I like that.
I think, like that a lot. Yeah. I just think maybe the way that they developed the character couldn't get an audience on his side, or couldn't, you know, but like that whole, like subverting that trope and making him the protagonist, I think is brilliant. And that's like the potential that I saw in the show, right?
Apparently,
for all its dumbness and all of its like problematic elements, like I really liked that element. Like I really liked that concept.
Apparently, as the series goes on, he gets worse and worse. And like,
yeah,
he's always described as being psychotic and psychopathic going on. So it's just, he's very dark.
So I think you each touched on what it would have taken to make the character truly work. Because with Kramer, often other characters find him annoying, but they also do like him and find aspects of him charming. There are aspects of him that come out as being a moral core, sometimes as counterpoint to other characters who are being more selfish. And there are a lot of elements in Seinfeld where other characters are envious of how Kramer can be so free and easy and not be sort of hemmed in by what most people feel are like the way they need to behave in this world. And he can sort of be himself and have that freedom. So a lot of people envy him too. So this character would have needed to have at least a couple other characters like wish they were him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. One of the first scenes is like, you know, he shows up at Larry's house and he's like, Larry, you're gonna, you know, we're going to an amusement park. You're gonna blow off work. And then Larry's wife comes in and she's already there, but she's not a fan of Chris at all for normal reasons. And we get to see like that they have a pretty bitter rivalry, like Chris and Larry's wife, Sharon. But one of my favorite bits of the whole scene is Larry's kids come in and they love him.
Yeah,
and I was just like, yes. I was like, of course you'd love this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was like very spot on as well. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And actually that bedroom scene actually kind of made me chuckle because I was like, what was with that era and these weird non-boundary scenes where friends show up in a bedroom? Like we saw that in Big Wave Dave's.
Yep.
It's just like this weird trope of.
And what was the other time we saw someone climb into an apartment window? That was in
I don't know,
with Patrick Harris.
Yeah, and where people just like barge into each other's homes. Like that idea gives me such anxiety. I would not want. I don't like when anyone shows up unexpectedly, let alone like in my bedroom.
Yeah,
like I just like that's my nightmare. But it was like a thing in these 90s sitcoms.
Okay, the other thing in
I would say it still is because I saw an awful lot of Big Bang Theory when I was staying at my mother's house. And that comes up a lot on that show.
That's weird,
I don't like it. Yeah.
The other thing that's like a late 80s, early 90s thing we've talked about this before. Someone having a very generic like business job where it's never really explained what they do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
his friend is totally that guy in this show where he works for, I had to laugh at this, Bushman and Simon, which reminded me like another Kramer reference of when he takes the job at Brant Leland. And it's just like, what do you do?
TCB. It's a great name. Yeah.
Taking care of business. And it's just like Bushman and Simon. He's just some generic businessman.
Yeah.
Doing whatever, but the boss is always busting his hump and he's part of the rat race.
I'm going to just throw this out there. As a generic businessman, the people in your life very often look at you as a generic businessman.
Yeah.
They don't know what you do. They don't know if you're in banking or insurance or anything. They just know you are a businessman.
Yeah.
And this comes up in my life a lot.
I mean, I'm sure it does. And I get it.
ITCB.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting that Chris wants to liberate Larry from his day and just wants to be like, hey, just, you know, I'm getting you out of the corporate grind for one day so you can live and you can be bohemian and free spirited like me and go have some fun in the middle of a day. You know, you deserve it. It's kind of like a fun message.
Yeah.
But yeah, it obviously backfires and the worst possible thing happens where they get stuck on a roller coaster and become a news item. Like they're
So the whole news subplot is great. Yeah. I love how that was the first bit of the show where I was like, I get where it's going to start getting surreal.
Yeah.
Because like all of a sudden the news is doing an interview with them while they're suspended in midair upside down, and they take up a giant crane to interview them, and then they're like, well, can't you help us out? And she's like, no, we're the news. We have to stay objective.
And
she
like yeah. goes, and they can't
you
rescue
just, like,
them.
Watch her go down yeah. like out of the yeah. frame? It's so good. Yeah. yeah.
Now,
like,
what I didn't care for is what the friend screams oh, at the yeah. news reporter moments after.
Yeah.
1990 was hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
So he screams whore and then slut, and then yeah. he screams both of those again. And I noticed the word broad getting repeated so many times that I had to do a count.
Yeah, it's rough. I don't even know if I want to give it the energy of getting into how this show is.
All I could say is every time they said broad, I was just like, oh, thank God they said broad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something, yeah, yeah. even worse.
Exactly. So,
yeah, it's like, it's not good. It's not a good show for women at all.
No.
By any means.
No, not by any means.
So, you know.
The women in this show are either like the icy shrew stereotype or get like defamatory language screamed at them.
Yeah. So
yeah, we're heavily sexualized.
Yeah.
Like in the opening credits.
Right. Where he's checking out this woman while
in
he's
every episode's opening
yeah,
credits.
Yeah. He's riding on his little bike delivering his papers, and then he checks out this woman and then ends up falling off of his bike and like crashing into a car. So yeah, it's, you know, it's your typical junk from the 90s that way.
Oh yeah. This often happens when I'm talking to you guys, but every now and then I'll be really shitting on something and then remember something I liked about it, which is there was a great back and forth in that bedroom scene, or maybe it isn't even in the bedroom scene. It's in the first episode. And Chris is just talking to Larry about his job, and he's like, yeah, like, you know, I just had to pull you out of that 9-to-1 grind. And he's like, it's 9-to-5. And he goes, oh boy, you're really putting in the hours down there. And it's like such a Kramer line that I just loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good line.
Yeah.
In terms of some of the like production details outside of the stories and characters, I immediately noted like right from the beginning of the pilot that I liked the decor of his bedroom. It had like this certain scrappy with that like fake wood grain wallpaper stuff, like very much of its time, like that extra spare room in a suburban house.
Yeah.
Kind of juvenile, but with other elements that are kind of adult. Like it really seemed perfect for it.
Yeah. I neither noticed nor didn't notice the decor of the room. I can't picture it.
The show doesn't spend a lot of time in that room. But I just know, Barry, you usually like pay attention to the sets.
This one didn't get me.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, he had that big Daryl Hannah poster. And then there's comments made later about how he's like obsessed with Daryl Hannah. And I'm like, oh, can't get more 90s than that, really.
Yeah. Like, yeah, you really can't. Really can't.
And yeah, and speaking of the 90s, there's some really great music thrown in there, and I don't know who was their music supervisor, but they got some real good gems. Like the opening theme song of the show is Stand by R.E.M., which was like a big earworm of the time.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
you all know it. You can all Google it. It's very much that kind of anthem of your everyman doing a thing. And and also, I was delighted that they had Head Over Heels by the Go-Go's. And they also had Living in America by James Brown. I was just like having a really fun time watching it for the music. And I was like, good for them.
Yeah, I had some on in the background while I was watching, and every episode had some absolute bangers.
Yeah,
and,
totally.
And I was looking at it, and the again, cult following, there was a big call to get this on DVD, you know, in the early thousands when, you know, like there's a huge fight for that. And they basically it finally did get a really solid DVD release by Shout Factory, who's like a big cult DVD producer. And the reason why it took so damn long was they had the creators still were like, we want all the music that we had in there because they couldn't get the rights to it. Right.
Right.
So they waited until they get the music back. Right. The show did end up rerunning in the early thousands on some niche cable network, and they had mostly removed all the music, including Stand, which
right? That's disappointing.
And it's funny because not only is Stand like the opening theme, but they definitely work Stand into like the theme music itself, like, or the incidental music for the episodes. Like you can hear the motif gets repeated. So
I had to watch the music video for Head Over Heels as soon as I was done watching it, because I was like, yeah, I just need to hear the whole song.
Also, the show has a lot of like cartoonish sound effects, and I don't love them. They're pretty cheesy, but I do love the like swing, like that they made a choice and committed to that choice. And as with the music, like they certainly put thought and effort into the soundscape of the show. Whether I agree with all of the choices or not, I'm glad that they made choices.
It almost feels like a movie from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
From the music to the high concept nature, you know, it just feels like Chris Elliott wanted to do movies. And then he goes on to, you know, do movies with the same kind of character, you know?
Yeah, like Cabin Boy was very much a spiritual successor to this. And it was done, I think it was done with Adam Resnick as well.
Yeah,
The two of them were both writers on Letterman. But like, as anybody who watches late night TV knows, oftentimes the writers usually end up being performers on the show.
Yeah.
And Elliot was a regular on Letterman at that point. So that's what would have gotten them this show.
Yeah.
And it's funny to see it's very much of his time, but like it's a live action cartoon. I mean, this is a show
absolutely
that ended 12 of its episodes with its main character dying. Like, and then him just being miraculously fine. And like, I'm glad because I'd heard about that. And I'm glad one of the episodes we watched had that, because I was just like, how is that going to work? And like, in the second episode we watched, like he just dies.
He gets shot multiple times.
And then he just bleeds out.
Well, so but the one little detail about that I found extra intriguing that kind of goes in the same vein as the sound effects that's cartoonish is that he gets shot multiple times in this police shootout, but initially he appears to not be suffering any repercussions from all of the gunshots.
I was so confused.
It's only in the moment where the cop, who will go back to this point, but he's living over the cop's garage, but the cop that he's living with is the guy who shot him, and and the guy says, sorry about shooting you all those times. And he's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. And then
he drops
dead.
He
like looks at his body, realizes he's been shot several times and drops dead. And it was like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff and doesn't fall until he looks down and realizes, oh, there's no ground below me.
Yeah.
It was totally like that.
It got a big laugh from me.
I don't know. I feel like the gag, it was a good joke, but the way they did it was not effective. Like the way that it was all put together was not effective, because I totally, like, you know, it just didn't hit for me.
So I think one of these things is you gotta imagine now that he's already died a bunch of times on the show. So it's like one of those, isn't this one of the times you're going to die at the end of the show?
That's true.
Looking at it from that angle, sure.
In one episode, he's crushed by a giant boulder, like a cartoon character.
We should step back and just address the plot a little bit of the second episode we watched. So at the very beginning, I was initially confused because it opens with him and this other guy where I thought, oh, did they recast the dad? And then I looked into it and realized, no, he moved.
Aaron, it's Brian Doyle Murray. Yeah. Come on, man. He's a goddamn icon.
Yeah, but I thought they replaced his dad from season one with a different actor playing his dad.
Me too.
And that's not what they did. He moved out of his parents' house, moves into the apartment above the garage of a neighbor who's a retired cop. His parents are still his parents, same as the ones in season one, who he does visit during this episode. But he comes down into the kitchen of this cop, played by Brian Doyle Murray. And this episode is written by Charlie Kaufman.
Which is wild.
Which is why we chose it. Because if we're gonna be watching the show, this is the first credited work by Charlie Kaufman.
Is it? Oh my god!
This is his first IMDb credit. Wow. Is this. He would later this wasn't Charlie's only foray into sitcoms. Like he would later go on to be a writer for the Drew Carey Show for a while.
Really?
I knew that.
It's funny. So this is weird, but you know this. This would not prepare you for the brilliance of Charlie Kaufman.
No,
not at all.
It doesn't even really necessarily feel like stylistically similar to other stuff that he's done.
He's got to be early to mid 20s.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So to briefly summarize the plot of this episode, do you want to do it or should I do it?
I'll do it real quick. Chris has a prison pen pal. Named Irma, who gets out of the slammer, and she comes to stay with him. He thinks they're, you know, destined to fall in love. She just wants to get right back into her criminal ways, which are as generic and broad as any criminal ways
so
possible.
Broad.
Yeah.
At some point, the cops are onto all of her various schemes and show up, and she takes Chris hostage. And the rest of the episode is a hostage standoff between Irma, Chris, and the cops. At one point, Larry's wife, Sharon, stops by the shootout and basically stops the whole thing because, she gets shot in her shoe or something. It's stupid.
Yeah, it's really stupid because she's just angry that her shoe got ruined. Because women be loving shoes and putting shoes above everything else.
Well, she's also pretty excited that Chris has been taken hostage.
Yeah, because she hates him.
That's
plays
true.
For good. Gets played for some pretty good laughs.
Right.
And the moment that what's the retired cop's name?
Gus.
The moment Gus steps out of the house, the cops just start lighting it up. It's just immediately like a full-blown massive shootout. And that cop starts shooting back at them and yelling at them to recognize who he is because he's retired from their department or whatever. Yeah. And then he joins sides with them and takes control of the sniper situation to try to shoot Irma.
The moment the gun, he has a gun eject from his sleeve.
Yeah.
Is just a great piece of physical.
Ridiculous.
Comedy. Yeah. I just loved it.
It's a very ridiculous episode of television. Yeah. I mean, there's some parts of it that are really rough. Like just the way that this newly released prisoner is written is really rough. Like the whole, it's bad. It's not.
And the way that she's deepening her voice in a very put on way to play that character.
She's played by a very game Nora Dunn, who is just any female convict voice you're picturing in your head right now out there. That's the voice. That's what she's doing.
Yeah,
she's doing the generic female convict voice.
What's the episode of The Simpsons where there's a Thelma and Louise type of parody and there's a female convict character?
I want to say it's called Marge in the Fast Lane.
It really seemed like she was modeled after that character with the jean jacket and the certain type of voice and demeanor, and it's her against the world, but Chris finds a dead body in his
it looks
garage,
like a dead gangster
like a dead
or something.
Gangster or something. Like it seems like she must have robbed a gangster, and then the garage is just full of all sorts of stolen merchandise and guns, and then there's this dead body, so it's like she must have
pretty cartoony by that point.
Real cartoony.
I like the second episode a lot more than I like the first episode. If we had ever gotten into rating shows on That Was a Show, which, 21 episodes in, probably not going to start now. But this is a very firmly I got some chuckles, but, I'm not going to be recommending it.
No.
No,
absolutely not.
Yeah. I was impressed that by season 2, episode 6, they had stuck to the level of high concept format where in the pilot, they spend half the episode stuck upside down in a roller coaster. In this episode, they spend half the episode where he's a being held hostage in the standoff with the police, where that's like literally half the episode.
I like that he doesn't realize until like very late in the episode that he's actually in danger.
Because she refuses to share a candy bar with him.
Yes, that's what the moment, that's the turning point where he's like, oh no, my life is in danger.
See, you know, it's funny that, you know, that whole thing just reminded me of, and then I realized the character does, a version of this character that works already exists. It's called Pee-wee Herman.
Like, right.
In the Pee-wee movies, this is a very similar, except Pee-wee's never selfish and never, you know, I take it all back. Pee-wee's a live action cartoon character who doesn't live in the real world, but everybody does find him charming and everybody does, you know, and he does sort of manage to bumble his way through things.
Yeah.
I do find Chris Elliott a little bit charming in this show, and it is that kind of demeanor he has where it's like happy-go-lucky, bumbling, but some scrappy confidence. And there is a bit of him where I can see this common thread in his style of performance that I see in other roles that he plays, and I even see in Schitt's Creek.
Yeah, 30 years later, he's still playing a similar type sense of humor that nobody else is really doing. Like, he definitely doesn't mind being completely unlikable in a role. Like, in fact, I think he thinks it's funnier the more unlikable he is.
The more annoying and grating he is. Yeah.
Like, his self-deprecation, I quite enjoy.
Yeah.
There's just even just tiny throwaway lines where, like, he's like in the second, like they very clearly establish him as 30 years old in the pilot. And then in the second episode, they mention him as being in his mid-50s. And then when they, and then when they report him dead, they say 50, the body of 58 year old paper boy.
And he talks about him. He's like, I'm too young and bloated to die.
Too young and bloated to die.
So there is something about him that wins me over in this show. But a lot of the other elements of this show kind of push me away.
Yeah.
One of the other episodes I watched in the background is he goes to male modeling school. Because he's like just so sure he's got the stuff for it. And like he encounters another character played by Brian Doyle Murray, who's like the leader of the modeling school, which in itself is also really funny. I found all that episode a little bit funnier just because of a lot of that. At no point in the episode does he ever have to learn that he is not male model material, which I find really funny.
Yeah. We have a special treat for you guys in this episode. So, do you remember when Steve Urkel appeared on Full House? Or when the Fresh Prince met George Jefferson? Well, we're going to do our own 90s style crossover. Another amazing podcast about weird TV of yesteryear is B-Watch Rewatch. Fabulous brother-sister duo Cadence and Colin rewatch and hilariously retell some of your favorite BTV. Late night classics like Baywatch Hawaii. Be sure to check them out. So I forced them to watch Get a Life so that I and you could hear their hot takes. Enjoy!
Howdy, 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 everybody. This is Colin from the B-Watch Rewatch.
And this is Cadence, also from the B-Watch Rewatch.
Such a cheesy radio intro.
We're just small town radio DJs.
KWBTV.
Just kidding. We're the hosts of the B-Watch Rewatch podcast, which is a podcast that we rewatch, reframe, retell the stories of the best BTV entertainment from the past.
Yes, it's so great. So if you haven't checked it out, go check it out now. So it only made sense.
Right. It only made sense that we were invited by That Was a Show to give our take on the magnificent masterpiece that was Get a Life.
Our hot take on the show Get a Life. How did this even get greenlit? Like, how it was it's an interesting show. So yeah, we're here to give our hot take on it.
We have so many thoughts about it and we don't quite know where to start. But we got to watch two different episodes, pilot episode and then episode 6 from season 2.
So we kind of got to see how it started, and then we kind of got to see how it was going in season 2. And yeah, lots going on.
And in the pilot episode, we are introduced to him. He's in his like fold out bed in the garage in his sweet, sweet man cave. But I just want to take a quick moment to acknowledge that he does sort of this comical, like he's getting ready in the morning and he's dancing and he's brushing his teeth. And he does what I like to call the quintessential white man, like whip dance, like lasso over your head. Like when like lanky white guys don't know what else to do, they default to
lasso. Lasso. You know what it's from? It's like that. Dun, jump on it. Jump on
all
it.
That right.
Wasn't that like in the 80s, 90s or something?
Tonto.
Jump on it. That's what it reminds me of. First off, within the first like 5 minutes, you're like, is this kid acting like he's 5? Is he a horny 12-year-old? Is he just a really mature college student? Like his maturity levels are wildly drastic through even the first 5 minutes. And so that first was like, okay, I can see where this is going, but I get the idea. Like he's he's kind of like this 30-year-old that lives with the mom and dad and kind of the paper boy, doesn't have much going for him, and he needs to maybe get a life.
Just maybe. We also meet his very best friend who is married and has children, and he is a responsible adult. Yeah. Oh, with chums.
Glasses with chums, and he sleeps in matching sleepwear with his wife, who also sleeps in matching sleepwear. And like Cadence said, in the first 5 minutes, there's casual breaking and entering. He literally crawls on someone's roof, breaks through the window, wakes his best friend up, sexually harasses his wife by telling her she needs to wear Victoria's Secret, and that he brings the Victoria's Secret magazine that he's like finished with and then gives it to her with all these things circled. And he was like, you need to wear this. And I'm like, dude. Like, already, who does this? This is your best friend's wife. Gotta have a little respect.
And it's not charming either. It's not like they razz each other, haha.
No, she hates him.
Yeah, she like wants him dead.
She hates him from the very beginning.
And he thinks that she is like just the most pathetic, unsexy, matronly old wife
lady. He's just like harassing her like, you need, basically. And then...
And not once does the friend defend his wife, mind you.
Not one freaking time. Which is amazing.
He's like, she is an old hag. You're right.
And he does meet the kids. His best friend's kids come in, and you can see that there's this connection with this Chris character because they just love him.
He's like a kid at heart.
Yeah, he's like a kid at heart. So you know that like that's what these kids like running and playing with them are. Mm-hmm. So you're like, you kind of go like, oh, he might actually not be terribly annoying.
No. And at one point, these two like hot, hot women in basically like bikinis come over and kiss him like one on each cheek. And I'm like, no.
That's what I mean. Like, that's what I said earlier about his character, like, wildly fluctuating between maturity levels. Mm-hmm. It's like, he's playing in a ball pit with kids, and then he's, like, this horny guy trying to kiss girls, and then he's, like, this weird 12-year-old. It's like, he can't identify, like, is he an annoying childlike guy, or what is going on with his age?
You have, and they might have been meaning to do this, but he does not have any redeeming qualities.
No.
Maybe that was a very bold choice they made, but there's nothing about him that is redeeming at all. Anyway.
They get stuck upside down, and this is where it's just like cheesy sitcom-y stuff. Like, gravity doesn't exist. There's no blood rushing to their head. The guy's tie is still facing downwards. His hair, like, they did each other's hair to make it look like they were upside down.
A little bit like they were upside down.
His glasses don't fall off. Nothing. It's just, they're
Well, because he has those chums.
Oh, you're right. Oh my God,
so tight from the get-go.
Now that's why they did that. Okay. They did that because they knew he was going to be upside down, and they knew that it glasses. And my first thoughts, I wrote it in my notes, might actually be one of the worst shows I've ever seen. Because at that point, the pilot episode was
the most regret I've ever experienced.
But it was interesting. I liked the interestingness of it. But yeah, we already know, no redeeming qualities. This guy's already, you're just like, who would ever be friends with this guy? Now we moved to season 2, episode 6. So it's like we jumped in a little head, see where it is, see where it's going. And Whew, weird episode.
You can see how the show in and of itself was kind of getting a little darker and a little more subversive as time goes on. There are a couple of things that really stood out to us from this episode. One of them that we both wrote down word for word is that the roommate, Chris's new roommate, says that when the woman gets there, she's going to be moist with terror. And we both literally wrote those words exactly like down. We were big,
like total, like capitalized letters, like underlined, yes, moist with terror. It was so nasty. I might describe things like that later. I might use moist with terror.
Might use that one. And then the other thing that we learned is that once you commit one crime, mm-hmm, well, A, mm-hmm, you will only ever be a criminal for the rest of your life, and you will never be defined as anything but, as Chris's parents call her, pathetic big house scum.
Everybody hates her instantly just because, yep, she went to prison. Granted, mm-hmm, she does commit every other crime in the book after that and, yeah, lives up to this stereotype. It's right. Like, come on, guys.
That was the thing. It was like, she maybe committed like a small like misdemeanor or whatever. No, it's like once you commit one crime, you're like, oh, well, now I'm going to have firearms, and now I'm going to launder money. Now I'm going to counterfeit money.
Murder,
now I'm
going to
sell
bodies.
Weapons. Now I'm going to hide bodies. Like, it escalated to every crime you could possibly commit.
In like
commit.
A day, too. She just, mm-hmm, gets out, and the next day, every crime that can be committed, she's committed because she
and
is
not
an
even subtly
con, you guys. That's just how it works. Yeah, and he's doing these weird things. Like, there's a point when he like kind of almost performs fellatio on the gun that she's holding to his head.
Oh, definitely.
Which was very weird to me because I'm like, what is going on? Is it supposed to be representative that he's like her prison bitch? Just, mm-hmm, weird stuff like that that didn't really totally make sense. That
sometimes
that
the tone was unclear, to say the least.
Unclear.
To say the least.
And his parents are always in robes, and they're kind of awful because the police at one point call the parents to go save their son because he's being held hostage, and they're like, no thanks, and hang up the phone, and the mom's like, put it off the hook. So there's just like this darker like undertone of like intense gun violence, ex-cons escaping from prison, awful parenting, mental illness, stereotyping, all thrown into this weird episode.
So I saw the name Bob Odenkirk in the credits, and I was like, well, Bob Odenkirk is a comedic genius. He's been around forever. He's a talented performer. He's a talented writer. There has to be something more. So when I started reading about this, it made a tiny bit more sense, where they were really making an effort to subvert the sitcom genre. So to give us like all this sort of darker thematic material that makes people uncomfortable, but giving it to us in a format that feels comfortable, which is a sitcom. On some levels, I want to give this more credit and say like it was ahead of its time because,
yeah,
the people
associated
with it.
Yeah, you almost kind of feel like it's ahead of its time. And we had a lot of fun watching the episodes, even if it was kind of cringy. We took a lot of notes, and we just totally on the same page. So
we talked about this a lot, just like in our personal time.
Yeah, so
it gave us a lot of material.
Thanks, guys, at That Was a Show. Thank you so much for having us, and thank you so much for bringing this gem into our life. And
thank
we
you.
Will see you later. Bye.
So Barry, why did you choose Get a Life?
It had come up in conversation before. I can't remember why. But I've been watching a lot of Schitt's Creek, and it just sort of popped out in my head. I was like, oh, yeah, there's that weird Chris Elliott show that everybody kind of always randomly talks about. I'm pretty sure people have also recommended it to us. Sorry if I forgot who did. But yeah, that's why I chose it.
I feel like it's a show that people who know it, but mm-hmm. generally people don't know about this show. Mm-hmm.
So I will say that this show, I think I would have liked it a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I would have enjoyed it more. I was a little bit more into the man-child thing back before I myself was a man-child.
Yeah.
Like when I was a boy-child, I would have preferred this to my right. current man-child self.
yeah, I mean, the 90s was all about man-children. You know, you had Wayne's World, you had all the Chris Farley movies.
All the Pauly Shore movies.
Yeah, like Sandlers.
Yeah, it was all about man-children. Like, that was just like the recipe for comedy back then.
Where's our man-children at?
I don't know.
Even Andy Samberg's our man-child, but Jake Peralta is a decent human being, so it doesn't count.
Yeah.
Yeah, this particular brand of unapologetic man-child that have that deeper layer of redeeming compassion and value, that's pretty much gone. I wouldn't be able to name a present-day popular character that's
The closest thing is Detroiters.
Yeah, yeah. That's the closest I've seen to that kind of style of of obliviousness.
And that show is like the smartest version of that I've ever seen. And I still would love to just start a campaign to bring it back because it is like the most fantastic comedy I've seen in years. Yeah.
I crave more of that show every day.
Yeah.
But yeah, that show has that immature obliviousness, but it's still not quite the same tone as these early 90s.
It's 30 years of perfecting perfecting the style.
Yeah.
So Bryn, what do you have for us for 6 degrees of Friends?
It's very straightforward. Get a Life is separated from the iconic sitcom Friends by 1 degree.
Okay, what's that degree?
Chris Elliott?
Nope.
Brian Doyle Murray?
No, it's Eleanor Donoghue, who plays Gladys Peterson on Get a Life. She guest starred on Friends as Aunt Lillian.
I wonder who's Aunt.
Well, how about that?
So, yeah, very straightforward. I'm sure there's many other connections. I just was like, oh, there's a 1 degree connection. Done.
How about the spinoff?
Well, the spinoff is pretty crazy. There's so many people involved in the show Get a Life that went on to do much bigger and better things. I guess we'll start with Charlie Kaufman, who wrote the second episode of Get a Life that we watched. He's basically a legend and one of the most innovative screenwriters that has been in the business in recent years. He's written some of my personal favorite screenplays of all time, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Being John Malkovich, and Adaptation. So yeah, so it's pretty wild that he got his start on this like funny little sitcom that didn't have a huge cultural impact. The cast, of course, were already very established comedic actors who continued to work on many television shows and movies after. Bob Elliott, who was actually Chris Elliott's real father. It's interesting because he has a career going all the way back to the 60s. And that the Elliott family is a very, very much a show business dynasty. You've got Bob Elliott and then Chris Elliott, and Abby Elliott is Chris's daughter. So it's pretty cool to see that tradition of comedians continuing. Bob Elliott wound down his career in the late 90s and actually passed away at the age of 92 in 2016. Sam Robards amassed several film and television credits, including reoccurring roles on The West Wing, Gossip Girl, and Tremé. Adam Resnick, one of the creators, went on to write for SNL and David Letterman and wrote a couple of films, including Death to Smoochie, which is a film that I really enjoy. Brian Doyle Murray continued to work in TV and became a very successful voice actor. You know, he's already pretty much an icon. One of his most notable voiceover jobs is playing the Flying Dutchman on SpongeBob SquarePants.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Chris Elliott, the star and co-creator, went on to be in Cabin Boy, which we already mentioned. Cabin Boy was basically this very high concept film that takes that trope of a man-child to a very wild degree. He had several supporting and reoccurring roles in film and television after. And most recently, he's notably known as playing Mayor Roland Shit on the smash hit and Canadian treasure Schitt's Creek. Both Eleanor Donoghue and Robin Riker continued to work, but found more success in dramas and soaps. Robin Riker was actually a main cast member on at least two other short-lived sitcoms of the 90s. So I feel like as we continue our podcast, we're going to see more of Robin Riker, and she's going to become one of our darlings in future episodes. David Merkin, one of the other co-creators, did continue to work as well, and most notably on The Simpsons, and he directed Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, which is one of my faves as well.
Nice. Who's in that movie?
it happens to be Lisa Kudrow playing a very similar character to...
To what character?
To Phoebe Buffay.
So Barry, I'm a network executive and you're a producer. Pitch me Get a Life.
Hey, Aaron.
Mr. Producer, you look a bit tired.
I've been up for days, and oh boy, do I have a show for you.
All right, let's hear it.
Well, I spent the weekend with young Hollywood heartthrob writer Chris Elliott.
Oh yeah, he's on Letterman sometimes, right? Heartthrob.
That's right. So on our show, he's going to play a version of his wacky self.
Okay.
But this one's a paperboy who lives with his parents.
That's kind of funny.
Right? Genius. He's going to get into all kinds of real-life zany suburban adventures. Like, in one episode, he'll get stuck on a roller coaster for like 8 hours. On another, he'll become a male model. Another, he'll get into a hostage situation.
Wait.
He'll meet aliens, he'll house sit a haunted house, he'll become a male escort.
Did you say aliens?
That's right. Aliens, Aaron. A lovable alien named Spewy the Alien. And he'll die, Aaron. Chris will die. He'll die over and over and over again in funny ways. He'll get shot. He'll be
I'm
pushed
gonna
off-
close the door on you now.
Fair enough. Maybe Fox will take it.
All right, guys. Well, that was Get a Life. Final thoughts?
Sometimes it can be great to see where your heroes got their start. This is not one of those times.
I feel like it's a show that had a lot of potential, but certain things got in the way, like bad writing and politically incorrect humor of the 90s, as well as production elements that people couldn't separate themselves from in order to sell a joke properly.
Mine is just, you want to buy a monkey?
Anybody? Does anybody remember that? It's from Cabin Boy. It's Dave Letterman's scene in Cabin Boy.
And cut to credits. No, my voice cracked. And cut to credits. That Was a Show is a production of Radio Gizmo. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and follow us on Instagram for info about upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends about it.
Next time on That Was a Show.
What is everyone's first reaction to this show?
I think I need a little foreplay first.
I guess it's just like trope-tastic, you know, like that's my first thought.
My first thought was Rhea Perlman. Awesome. When do I get to see Danny?
My first thought, to be perfectly honest, is a very minor detail. I like the way the opening titles are just the main character writing her name on a chalkboard in cursive.
Loved that. Loved it. It works as a perfect capper to like a cold open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.